Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dr. Abousaleh Sharif, who is the Executive Director and Chief Scholar at the U.S.-India Policy Institute in Washington, D.C., where he's engaged in policy research that impacts both the U.S. and Indian governments. He has been a Chief Economist at the National Council of Applied Economic Research in New Delhi and was a member of the Ministry of Home Affairs in the Government of India and was an advisor to the Indian Prime Minister from 2004 to 2006, reviewing the inclusive growth policies in the context of Muslims, the largest of India's minorities. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Abousaleh Sharif.
Thank you, Ian.
So this new leader of India, who, by the way, was still technically banned from coming to the United States, and the ban was still in place on the day of his victory. There's a great fear amongst some people in both in India and abroad that think because Modi was a supporter of the right-wing pro-Hindu social movement, the RSS, that there will be signs that his government could be much less tolerant of criticism, hostile towards press freedom, and polarize the country along religious lines. Do you expect that to happen?
The history of India's independence is full with the recorded events where right-wing Hindu political parties, right-wing Hindu ideology has been taking firm roots as we move forward. We are 67th year after independence, and the BJP as a party has already ruled twice. At least once it had a full term. So the BJP rule is not new to India. Even the minorities, including the Muslims and the so-called secularists and intellectuals, they are used to living in an environment where BJP has already made policies. Narendra Modi was an RSS, Rashtriya Swayam Sevak. This is a social group. It is pan-Indian. It exists all over India, but mostly governed by high caste communities. High caste. India, the caste system is very deep in India, so it is regulated or it is managed by the high caste groups. But this is the first time that an OBC, a non-high caste person, that is Modi, has taken the reign of the BJP as the prime minister. That may be one of the reasons why he got support from a large number of people, because he doesn't belong to a high caste community. However, Modi himself has a bit strenuous relationships with the RSS. Generally, Modi tend to suggest that when the communal riots took place in Gujarat in 2002, although he was the chief minister, the whole killing and the carnage was done by the RSS and other ultra-extreme groups like Vishwa Hindu Parishad and Bajrang Dal. And also, in spite of the fact that he was constitutional authority, he should have taken actions to stop massacre. The Indian courts somehow, for unknown reasons, are unable to make him responsible. So this gives the impression that the Indian judiciary is not free from political influences or even to a certain degree the ideological influences. So India is in that sense a melting pot of different ideas. India is an emerging, not only an economy, but also it is maturing its democracy is maturing slowly. But the unfortunate thing is that in democracy, it is the majority who rules. But unlike in United States, where the majority is closer to 50%, in India, it has never been 50% ruling the country. It has always been around 30%. For example, this time BJP got about 30% of the votes. So 61%, actually, to be precise, electorate did not vote for BJP or Modi. So in that sense, it is not a majority government. In fact, it is a government of the minority people. The reason is that one of the defects of Indian democracy is that there are hundreds and thousands of registered political parties. For example, it is possible that there are 200 people contesting for the same member of parliament position for Lok Sabha, the lower house. And given that situation, a person who can take as little as 20% of the votes, sometimes even less, can win the elections.
So tell me.
I hope you understand.
Yeah, no, I do.
You understood the situation.
I do understand the situation, and it is surprising because all of the press reports are talking about an electoral triumph, and congratulations are coming in from around the world. But as you point out, Modi's stunning victory still only represents 30% of the country, which is definitely a paradox. But let's try and talk about who this man is, Dr. Abdullah Sharif. Is he the fact that he, as a young man, was married and had a child, but denied that for the rest of his life and then lived a celibate life in accordance with, with the Hindu religion in its more fundamentalist form, I imagine, right?
Yes. Yes. In Indian politics, unlike in the United States, we have the example, recorded example of President Clinton here, you know, how the personal life becomes so important in politics. But somehow in India, some of the so-called personal traits or personal attributes are not generally used in political decision-making. But what Narendra Modi's personality suggests is that he has now a kind of absolute power because of the majority, the BJP party alone, has more than 272 seats. There is a possibility of an authoritarian decision-making. And actually, people craved for such kind of decision-making, although that is not the best way for an analyst like me and others. That's not how India's decision-making should be done. It has to be done through consultative process. It has to be done by taking opposition views into account. And that is how our decisions should be made in democracy. But somehow our electorate tend to think that the previous prime minister was weak. Although I think in my view, one of the best prime ministers India has ever seen was Dr. Manmohan Singh. Because during his tenure as prime ministership, India has seen best of the economic growth, and India has seen fairly good, peace and harmony, and relationships with neighboring countries, and also balancing relationship with superpowers, the so-called like United States and Europe and Russia. And now China. So those balancing acts were done substantially fairly well during Manmohan Singh period. But now we believe that some of the decisions which Modi may take could be autocratic, could be knee-jerk reaction to a few things. So, there is a possibility of nuclear some sort of nuclear decisions like the Vajpayee regime took. You know, if you recollect, when Vajpayee became the prime minister, the BJP party, and then there was a nuclear blast in India. So there is an expectation that something of similar nature may happen to just make an announcement that the power is with this person and the power is with the BJP, which is a nationalist party. It is a kind of non-secular party. It is a party which doesn't recognize the human rights of the minorities, particularly the religious minorities.
But in the fact that Mr. Modi, the first thing he did after being elected was to go to Varanasi, the holiest city, where he went to the Lord Shiva's temple. So how much of a religious fundamentalist is he, given that he was apparently embarrassed by the fact that he was married and had a secret child that he has lived a celibate life? What is give me a sense in Hindu religion how that would relate, say, in the American political context? Who would be that religious in America's political context?
Well, from the point of view of the Indian, the electorate will not bother much whether he had a wife or not at the moment. The charisma and of Modi alone is hanging on, but judiciary could have taken a role, because in his first he contested from two seats. From the first seat, Vadodara, when he declared under oath, you need to declare before you become a candidate. He did not declare that he was married, but that declaration took place when he was filing his application from Varanasi, the second constituency. So obviously there are lies and truths. So judiciary and the election commission by now should have taken some decisions about it, and they have obviously ignored, and they allowed him to contest and win both these elections, although the declaration was untruthful. So this is the point which I'm making. In India, we still have our democracy, still our democratic institutions, our judicial institutions, our bureaucracy and bureaucratic institutions are still not matured enough. We have not put the rules of the game in their, in the best form.
But in terms of him being religious and the extent to which he is a religious fundamentalist, could you compare him to anybody that we would recognize in the American political landscape?
Well, that is
the Reverend Pat Robinson, for example.
Right. Well, because I'm a bit new to United States history of government, so I presume that you may have some people of that nature. But in the last 2 years I am in the United States, I have seen that one of the mayors are likely contestant in New York City. He had extramarital affairs, and he had to withdraw because of this reason, if I recollect correctly. So there are more openness and there are more transparency the way democracy functions in the United States, but it's not the case in India.
Mm-hmm.
Well, please bear in mind, in my judgment, the Modi is not a religious person.
Well, would you
he is using religion to come into power?
Oh, so let's focus on that then. You're saying he's not a religious person, even though
he is not a religious person. It is the show of religion. It is the religion which is used to polarize and win the votes. It has never happened in the history of India that so many people voted on the pretext that the Muslims in India, who are exactly who have all the same attributes like any Indian citizen. Genetically, the Indian Muslims are similar, physically, they speak different languages, their diversity is as diverse as Hindus. For example, the Muslim living in Kerala, they don't speak Hindi or Urdu. The Muslims staying in Bengal, they can't understand anything other than Bengali. So the Muslims are very diverse, and they are there all over India. But in spite of that, the BJP party was able to create a devil out of the Muslim community. They presented Muslims as a danger for the Indian community, including, for example, some of the BJP guys telling, okay, most all the terrorists in India are Muslims. They belong to that community, which is actually not correct. So the use of religion to win votes, it has happened glaringly right in front of us, in front of the whole world, and we can't do anything about it. Actually, you can't ask votes by taking religion in the name of religion. But if you create a communal riot, you already made that statement that during the elections or just before the elections, you create a communal riot and kill, in Muzaffarnagar about just a month before the elections or 2 months before the election, almost 100 Muslims were killed. The reason behind that killing was one of the lieutenant of Modi himself was in UP for pre-electoral arrangements, and he has been instrumental in creating this riot. But the fact is, now the police and the judiciary don't think that there is a direct evidence of involvement. It is the same rule which was applied to Modi when 2002, more than 1,000 people, 1,000 Gujaratis were massacred on the streets and homes of that state. And then the chief minister of that state is not held responsible. So you could see how the institutions, democratic institutions, are manipulated in India.
Well, I'm afraid we've run out of time, but we're ending on a very disturbing note, because what you're telling us is that Modi is not so much a religious fundamentalist as that he is a cynical man who uses religion for political power, and does so in ways that cost the lives of innocent people in politically manufactured riots. So that is not something that we can feel very comfortable about.
That is something which I think politically President Obama and the American government must engage India, because India is a big economy. If America withdraws from India, it hurts people, including minorities, minority Christians, minority Muslims. But as a person, Mr. Modi should be held responsible for his previous misdeed, and then the international human rights groups and international democratic the institutions which promote democratic values should take up this position at the international level.
Well, Dr. Absalah Sharif, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much.
Again, I've been speaking with Dr. Absalah Sharif, who is the Executive Director and Chief Scholar of the U.S.-India Policy Institute in Washington, D.C., where he's engaged in policy research that impacts both the U.S. and Indian governments. He has been a Chief Economist at the National Council of Applied Economic Research in New Delhi, and was a member of the Ministry of Home Affairs in the Government of India, and was advisor to the Indian Prime Minister from 2004 to 2006, reviewing the inclusive growth policies in the context of Muslims, India's largest minority. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.
man who runs the free one time.